I think that's one of the things that makes operations work for me. You know, I like new challenges, new things keep my mind engaged. I get kind of bored easily, and so every day is a new problem to solve, something to tackle, right? So it's been a great career path for me because I get creative problem solving every day. Maybe more stressed than I'd like at times, and less relaxing than if I were just, you know, being a musician. But, you know, definitely, I think making a huge impact and also very fulfilling.
This is the Once a Scientist podcast. I'm Nick Edwards. We're back with new episodes, so keep an eye out and subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. All right, it's my pleasure to have Jake Haworth. It's pronounced Haworth, right?
Haworth, but it's close enough, Nick.
Okay, let me start over. It's my
feeling. I think it's a great intro.
There we go. We're sticking with it then. Jake Haworth. I should know this.
Yep.
I know you.
Ha as in ha-ha and worth as in worthless.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. Well, I wouldn't say you're completely worthless. Jake Haworth is an associate director of research and early development operations at Moderna. So he works in operations. I've known Jake for a little while. We worked together at Alloy Therapeutics. He's on the leadership board at LabOps Unite, a community that helps promote careers in operations and lab operations. Jake has a background doing science. So he did his undergrad at the University of New Mexico, spent some time at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, both as a research tech as well as a lab ops manager. And then, you know, has since spent some time at multiple, you know, biotech companies as well as, I guess early stage pharma with Moderna now. So Jake, we keep in touch, but it's good to have you officially on the Once a Scientist podcast.
Thanks, Nick. Appreciate the intro and happy to join and, you know, share my experiences with everyone. And hopefully people find it interesting. But, you know, if I were a, you know, early 20s person, mid 20s, late 20s person, I would have loved to hear people's experience in operations, because I don't think it gets the glamour or the attention that a lot of other careers within science have. You know, there isn't a lab operations undergraduate degree or master's degree. So hopefully what I share will be interesting and will be a bit niche for people if they haven't heard of it before.
Yeah, I think it'd be really interesting, and it'll be a unique perspective, definitely from prior or previous episodes, because you know, I've interviewed many people in R&D types of roles, and R&D doesn't work without operations. Like it's not like you can't actually get research done. You can't actually bring drugs to market without some sort of operations. And so, you know, it's an interesting perspective. And I think that it's not something that probably a lot of scientists have been exposed to. So, you know, just kind of jumping in, would love to hear, like, from your perspective, like, how you came into operations, and then, you know, let's go into like what it actually is.
Sure. So I started my career in biochemistry with the intention of having a career being a scientist. And my undergraduate degree at University of Mexico, I'm from Albuquerque, grew up there, and had been working at Sandy Nesha Labs as an intern. And I had planned to just have a career after I graduated there. But, you know, series of events out of my control happened. What actually happened was my boss passed away suddenly. And right when I graduated, I didn't have someone who could hire me on as a scientist. So suddenly I found myself out of college right when I graduated without a job and had to rethink what I was going to do next. And in Albuquerque, there's not a ton of other, you know, biotech science-y companies to work at. I was working in DOE, and so after about a year of just being a young adult, traveling, playing music, stuff like that, I decided to move to where I wanted to have my career. And my criteria were, I wanted to work in biotech. I wanted to live in a place that had a subway, because then I would have made it.
Okay.
And then I also, you know, in my personal life, I like to do stand-up comedy and play music. So those are really my criteria for finding a place to work. And so of that criteria, you know, biotech hubs is Boston or kind of San Francisco, maybe San Diego, New York, a little bit in there. But in terms of the subway system and all that, I wanted to have that experience living in a place where I could just hop on a subway, and that seemed really cool. And that landed me on Boston. So I just put my stuff in my car and drove out because I couldn't get a job just hiring interviewing remotely at the time. And I came to Boston 2015, did not have a job, did not know anyone in Boston, and hadn't ever met anyone or been to the city before. And within, you know, a month and a half, I had offers from the Broad Institute and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute as a research technician, because my plan was I just need a job in science. Once I get in, you know, I'll make my way. Yeah. And I got a job as a research technician at Dana-Farber and was planning to do research for a bit, then go to grad school and, you know, do a postdoc, be a scientist. I wanted to do virology because I thought viruses were sort of the future of where a lot of biotech was going to go. Similar to the way, you know, in the 20th century, a lot of it was defined by bacterial research, antibiotics, that sort of stuff. The future seemed to be within viruses at the time to me. But 6 months in at Dana-Farber, my lab manager for the group I was supporting left the Lowe Center for Thoracic Oncology and went to Novartis, you know, switched from academia to get a job in industry. And so our lab suddenly was without operations. So as someone doing research at the bench, basic research as a research technician, I still needed, you know, my reagents I was ordering for experiments. I needed the equipment that we were working with to get fixed and get PM'd. And we had, you know, all sorts of things just for making the lab work, waste pickup, safety inspections, and all this kind of stuff that I just started doing because I needed things to happen as the scientist at the bench to continue my work.
Yeah.
And after doing this for a few months, interviewing people, you know, I sort of felt, you know, I'm pretty good at this. This is really interesting. My day to day is not just, you know, I'm gonna put down pipetting, but I was kind of bored already within 6 months of just sitting in a bench pipetting. And this job suddenly seemed a lot more interesting. I'm working on a day-to-day basis with procurement and negotiating, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for equipment. I had never done that before, right? That seemed suddenly very interesting and businessy and exciting, right? And so I asked if they'd be interested in hiring me into this role. And they said, we were hoping you'd say that. They couldn't find someone who would be able to do this job, right? So I became a lab manager.
Why is that? Why is it hard to find somebody in operations?
It's a unique skill set. So oftentimes, so to support a biotech or let's say a biology lab or a chemistry lab, to support those scientists well, you need that person in operations to understand what they're doing. You need to understand, oh, I need to run a bunch of ELISAs today. Okay, what does that mean? They're going to need plates. They're going to need these types of reagents. Or I'm doing a bunch of, a scientist comes to you saying, I have a FACS experiment today and I need XYZ. XYZ could be, you know, let's say particular buffers or fluorophores or, you know, agents for staining, you know, these cells that they've already harvested. And there's the clock is kind of ticking. You have to innately know that and have the understanding of how to prioritize work, because every second in operations, it's another thing. It's another, oh, this equipment is down, this fax machine is down, and I have these cells that are literally on the bench dying that I need to stain, right? Or I need to run, you know, they're not fixed or something like that. So to be a good operations person and support a lab well, you need to understand what the scientists are doing, what's important to them, and why it's important. And that's a unique skill set, right? You kind of need someone who's been trained within science, but you also need someone who has the business acumen, who understands how to make negotiation decisions on equipment, who understands the high-level business process, who understands the financing and the budgeting of how you do procurement, what areas you're supporting, you know, when equipment goes down, the process of how we get it fixed. Do we hire outside people? Do you call Thermo Fisher for the brand? You know, some instruments have a very particular vendor and these come in and service them on a certain timelines, right? or otherwise they go out of spec, out of calibration, you know, all that kind of stuff. You have to know kind of from working within a lab or having that background. And so it's hard to get someone who's at sort of a base lab manager level to support 20 scientists, because that skill set you find in someone who's a director of operations, who has an MBA and they've spent 10 years doing, you know, lab stuff, and then they are now doing BD and they are sort of at this higher level, can speak to the large overall picture, the big picture for how the lab is working, but they're not the person who's going to also be willing to go in and fix the autoclave glassware when it's needed, autoclave media for, you know, plates, for all these sorts of things that you need someone who kind of wants to roll up their sleeves and get their hands dirty in the lab. So it's a really complicated mixture to make someone a good operations support role within the biotech lab space, both in bio and chem areas. And so because of that, for instance, the person who had been managing lab before I took on that role at Dana-Farber, you know, Ivy League school, master's level degree in the sciences, and went to Novartis because I think they could make more money. And academia doesn't pay as well, you know, and got mortgages and all sorts of stuff. And so I found that role in supporting that need for the group, that became an eye-opener for me of, oh, this is a whole career and I could be really good at it. And also for the lab, they're like, wow, this kid is, you know, doing a good job for us and we can't find anyone else and he wants to do it. And I can't exactly speak to why they chose, you know, why they agreed to it, but they were like, great, yeah, fantastic, finally someone's going to do this for us. And it came with more money. At the time, I, you know, was only making 38 grand a year as a research technician. And
which is actually as much as a PhD student in a lot of cases, if not more.
Right. And, you know, part of the thing is I was working in a lab with PhD students, postdocs, you know, oncologists doing rotations, that sort of thing. And I had this plan of still going to grad school, still pursuing virology, right? But I would say the vast majority, I'm not going to put a number on it, but the vast majority of the, let's say, 20 scientists in the lab all said grad school was not worth it.
Interesting.
And so for me, and this was an international lab, the person running this lab was from Finland, and there was a lot of, you know, people from all over the world, oncologists and surgeons and postdocs and graduate students and all this sort of stuff. And I had all these different perspectives of, wow, this seems like a really hard system to make it here as a scientist. And they were saying, why would you go through that process here? It doesn't make sense to go through 4 years of undergraduate, you know, go through a graduate school program, let's say 5 years there, then do additional years in a postdoc making what I was already making in academia. And then you, what, hope to find a job as a scientist one or as something like that within industry? It just seemed like such a long game to me. I was like, well, then why don't I just go to medical school? You know, I just couldn't, the math just didn't add up to me. And so for me, it seemed like another alternative career that suddenly made sense. And over the 4 years that I was a lab manager at Dana-Farber, I, you know, grew that skill set, and I continued to think, oh, I'll probably still go to medical school or law school or something, because in my mind, I was still in those boxes of what I could do and be a, you know, a successful person in society. And so that was kind of, in my mind, there's these kind of limited boxes of what I could be as a person contributing within science, or within, you know, the community at large. And this career, I was unaware of. So it became a very good opportunity for me to, one, support the science, make the lab very efficient. And overall, my input as an operations person, I would say, was many factors higher than me as an individual contributor as a research technician.
What do you mean by that? Well, your input, like, are you saying like the impact that you can make?
Yeah, absolutely. Because every day looking at, you know, putting 30 orders through procurement, negotiating, $100,000 IncuSight or things like that, the impact I'm making seemed to me, after 4 years of doing it, much more scaling in terms of the broader downstream of what I was doing, supporting the scientists, making their experiments go faster, making the data go through the pipeline faster, at the end of the day, making something that would go into a paper or it would go into the translational arm of the lab that would then could go into impacting patients, you know, that sort of stuff. At the time, you know, as a research technician, I was creating primary cell lines and taking raw pleural effusions from patients and creating those and, you know, working with stuff like that. But it was so upstream of anything actually impacting a patient that I saw the operations work is far more tangible of, okay, today I saved X amount of money on a negotiation. I made all these orders go through. We had, you know, this safety incident that could have shut down, this area or whatever that we dealt with and got ahead of. There was a facility issue with, let's say a cryo tank goes down. You've got years and years of patient collections and samples in that tank, for instance, that if someone doesn't fix it immediately, it's gone. There's no way to get back those patient samples. So that sort of impact seemed just so much more tangible and understandable for me. For what I could do to support the overall process of scientific discovery.
That's a really interesting perspective. And I think one that like is not obvious. Because like when you're doing research, a lot of times you think like it's the discoveries that I make, it's the it's the product that I'm making that's actually the valuable thing. But like what you're saying is like essentially what you are is like a force multiplier or like a catalyst, for other discoveries to happen, for people to do things faster and to do them more efficiently. Because you need people on both sides. And I think like it's interesting kind of seeing it on the ground and actually having worked in biotechs before, right? Because like neither side really understands what the other side, I guess on the operation side, you actually have a pretty good understanding of what people do.
I have a high level understanding of what they're doing, but sometimes if I sit in a lab meeting and they're talking about a very specific, antibody and I'm looking at Western blots, I understand what a Western blot looks like, but I may not understand all the downstreams of the molecules that they're interacting with, that sort of stuff, because I'm not as technically, literate in their specific field. You know, just about any PhD talk that I would go to, it would all go over my head. I understand generally what they did, but the specific mechanisms and stuff like that, I would get lost in. But if you were to talk about, in terms of what you're saying, the other side, people would understand if we had this sort of conversation, what's important about operations. So for instance, the next few years of my career when I was in startups and managing operations teams and building operations teams for these small scalable, startup companies, I was doing stuff like, okay, we're 19 people now, we're planning to be 150 after our next series, in X years, we need to do a spacer search. So I was working with the CEO and my boss, the co-founder, and doing real estate searches for biotech, where a biotech hub would want to be. And we were doing analysis of where all the demographics are. What's the commutes like in these different areas? What does that mean for the composition of your company, your small startup company that you're trying to build? Are these going to be new grad students all wanting to drive out to middle of nowhere? Most of them don't have cars. You're going to need to be near a T-stop in, the subway area if you want to get those sort of composition of young people who are all excited to want to be in a startup. They are, bright and bushy-tailed coming out of their programs. They really want to be part of something big, and they're willing to put in that high level of work and effort to build something, right? All the way from space searches to interviewing architectural teams, working in designing a new lab spaces, new headquarters, doing build-outs of, $10 million plus spaces, managing those construction projects and all that. Just within the facility side of what I was managing, you can see how thoughtfully designing, thinking through what a biotech company would need at all those stages of growth, your impact is going to be, a huge multiplier down the line for where the company goes strategically. If you've designed a space that's you know, 50% lab, 50% office, and you have to outsource all of your stuff to Vivarium because you didn't build one, that could be a huge impact on your budget if you're doing a lot of in vivo studies, right? And so there's an analysis of what square footage of Vivarium would we need? How much, you know, space can we allocate if we have these other program arms, if we want to do bacterial work and tissue culture and stuff like that? So there's all these conversations that can happen sort of at a board level or in a theoretical space from a strategy side of a company, especially early stage startups, of what we want to do, what we can do with our technology, what we want to pursue in a discovery space. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to actually building something and putting walls up, and this is a TC room, you know, it has X amount of air changes per hour, all this kind of stuff, it is very concrete, literally. And it's not exactly a theoretical thing that you can change. So you have to be tightly ingrained with the strategy side of the company for where are we going and what are we going to want to do in the future? What might we want to pivot into? All that sort of stuff becomes really important for you to be very well connected with, as well as understanding the downstream of X amount of scientists who need support, X, you know, linear feet of bench space is what they are going to need. You know, if we're looking at a capital equipment list and we're planning liquid handlers and we're planning analysis machines and all these different things, great. How much bench space do we actually have? How many scientists are we planning? If we're planning X headcount in a few years, does this mean we're going to have to move to a new headquarters to support this? Or, you know, your whole plan for what your company looks like from a startup to X years out is basically operations for how that gets put into place and into practice and whether or not that succeeds ultimately.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're working really across a pretty wide array of different like job functions, and you really have to kind of be a connector between many different types of work. Right. How do you keep things going among so many different dimensions?
Well, I'll give a shout out to Winston Yan, the co-founder of Arbor Biotechnologies, who was my manager when I first joined there. Ruthless prioritization. And that means, you know, there are some things that we're going to let the ball drop because we can't be perfect in all these areas. We can't drop the ball on the really important stuff. So when you're talking about all these areas you're trying to support, you have to prioritize what is the most critical thing right now and what is the most critical thing, you know, in steps 2, 3, and 4, right? And beyond that, you're trying to align with the overall strategy and that sort of thing. But working with all these different departments, besides first ruthlessly prioritizing what is actually the most important thing and acknowledging that things, hey, this is something that is maybe important, but not critical right now. So we're going to push it over here. That's a very tactful conversation. You've got to build those people skills with, you know, people wanting to implement a new, you know, a procurement system or HRIS system with an HR or all these different things that they want to help, you know, get bandwidth from you to help roll out or whatever. It comes down to that prioritization conversation, first of all. But secondly, when you're sitting down all these conversations, I came out of, you know, 5 years basically at Dana-Farber and 4 years at Sandia National Labs as an intern before that, when I went hit the ground as a operations manager at a startup company. And I was now suddenly a team of 20, and you have basically your finance department is a guy, you know, your HR department is one girl over here, and, you know, all these different people, you see a department in a person. And so when you sit down and you talk to these people who really know their stuff within each of these areas, I would say the most important thing is to be humble and don't act like you know what you don't. And so I asked ton of questions and felt often like I looked like an idiot who didn't know anything, but I soaked everything up like a sponge. Yeah. And so I learned a lot of things about HR. I learned a lot of things about accounts payable and procurement and finance and financial planning analysis, FP&E, which becomes FP&A, which becomes incredibly important to, you know, senior leaders within an organization for doing different analyses of what your runway is within a startup, all that kind of stuff. with your scientific heads, with their, you know, strategy, and all these different groups, legal, et cetera. I rolled out electronic lab notebooks, and, you know, we're trying to protect IP. IP was a huge conversation at the time, as Arbor had come out of Feng Zheng's lab at the Broad, co-discoverer of CRISPR. At the same time, you know, Broad and was having a conversation with, well, maybe not exactly conversation, but perhaps a legal battle of the patent of CRISPR, right? IP was a huge thing for us to tackle and to do it head on. And also, you've got all these priorities as a small company trying to, you know, get your ducks in line. So, you know, you're working with legal as well, and implementing things to protect your IP as you make discoveries, right? So coming into all those groups and acknowledging, hey, I don't know everything here. I don't know much, but I'll tell you exactly what I know. And when it's outside of my expertise, tell me what I don't know. I'd love to learn, right? And just being humble about the process. I think that's probably the easiest way to build a bridge with someone who, you know, really knows their stuff across from you in an area that is beyond just what you've learned, right? But that's sort of what operations' key role is to be able to flex into all these areas. And so now, for instance, Moderna Therapeutics, our role is managing business operations, lab operations for a platform group of, you know, 300 to 500 scientists, depending how you cut it. And if you're looking at these teams, our job is to make sure the scientists can focus on science.
Yeah.
And so when they have issues with procurement and order, you know, equipment is down, they need to buy new equipment, a logistical package is coming through, or we're building a new facility. We're currently building a over 500,000 new square foot headquarters in Kendall Square in Cambridge. And you need to be the main stakeholder and know what the scientists need and advocate for them. You're not going to be able to have 500 scientists in a meeting talking about what their needs are in this new facility, right? So that's sort of that main flex point, working with all these different stakeholders, is being able to flex and understand where they're coming from, be an advocate for the scientists. But I would say the most important thing is prioritize ruthlessly. And second is to be humble and don't act like you know something when you don't.
I love it. Yeah, that's those are, I think they're kind of important just in general, regardless of what role you're in. But I can imagine, specifically in operations, it's incredibly important because like the scope is so big, and there's just so many things to learn and so many things to be doing at any given point. That makes a lot of sense. What gets you excited? Like what's the draw to doing this type of position?
You know, I dated a surgeon at one point, and we would have this conversation about what makes us feel good about our job. And I would say, you know, there's a potential that in my job, let's say we make a breakthrough in cancer or you know, that sort of thing. If you look at the death rate, that's a massive impact. Let's say it's a rare disease. You impact thousands of people. You know, the potential for what you're working on within biotech and pharma to impact someone in the world at scale is kind of unprecedented. You know, to make even a small improvement in the quality of life for someone who's suffering from a debilitating illness, or it's something that, you know, is what we think of as perhaps a fairly manageable illness. So for instance, I have GERD, but if someone came out with a drug that was better than standard of care for the market, for making my quality of life better, I would be so thankful for that. One of the things when I was a kid is that I had really bad acne, and that was one of the first experiences I had with the medical process. I went to a dermatologist and said, what can we do here? And he said, well, there's this drug called Accutane, which was a cancer therapeutic that didn't seem to work for cancer. But hey, we found this side effect of it seals off your pores, essentially, and lowers your oil production, and it helps with acne. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So I took it as a teenager, And I was online and I went, I was like 14, 15. And so I went home and I Googled Accutane and I read, you know, it was the first time I understood. And he was saying, explaining to me that they've done studies that X percent of people found this beneficial. The X, you know, Y percentage did not find it, or this percent had side effects. And it was kind of a eye-opening, brain-exploding thing for me. It's like, oh, there's people out there who study how to help people, and we have data on how helpful it is, right? I mean, when you break it down, that's essentially what clinical trials are. And so for me to go online as a teenager and read about what how these trials work and the percentages that are helpful and all the patient arms and all this sort of stuff, that's sort of the first epiphany moment for me as a young person of how that process worked. And it was so life-changing for me, for, you know, a teenager who had such bad acne. I had severe acne. So it was, I mean, the medical term was acne vulgaris. So, I mean, it's as if the dermatologist said, it's not just that you're ugly, you're offensive. but that whole process was so eye-opening to me that, wow, people study this of how to help people, how these small molecules, it's sort of like magic, but it's better than magic because it's real, it's backed by data. And that started me on this whole search from a young adult into how science actually works and how we can make data-based decisions and how it all wasn't just, well, magic, you know, that there was something more there that you can harness as a tool and as a process to make people's lives better. And that's essentially what I see science as. So to answer your question, I saw biotech and pharma as being able to scale that impact on a person. Whereas when I was dating this surgeon, she was saying, I helped 6 people today. And it was so, you know, amazing. She came home and thought this was a fantastic experience and that, you know, she knows what got her up in the morning and what she'll get up in the morning for the next day. For me, you know, 6 people was peanuts. it's fantastic of, you know, the work those people do. But for me, I found that in terms of, you know, I could help millions and millions and millions of people live a better life, a longer life, happier life. Like even in the situation I had experienced as a teenager. So, I think that's what motivates me.
Yeah, you put it really well. And I think that it's great that you have that kind of that broader vision in terms of like the day to day. It sounds like the way that you approach operations, and I know you, like I've worked with you before, and so you know, you approach operations like from a very rigorous data driven perspective. And so like you know, how is it similar in some ways to what somebody might do as a researcher, and like what are the ways in which it's like vastly different?
That's a good question. I have to remember to throw in some compliments for the podcast host every now and then. It's a good question, Nick. So I actually did a workshop today about insights discovery, where you understand your personality and the personality of your team, that sort of thing. And my personality, my base personality outside of work is 98% analytical. So that I think is a good thing for me when operations role. Everything we do is backed by data. You're going to make a change to your process. All of your stakeholders within the scientific community are going to say, why? Show me the data. Show me how. And I can speak that language. And so there's a similarity there. Oh, we're going to do a new procurement process, a new ordering system. We're going to do a new process for how you receive packages. We're going to do a new process for how you submit IT tickets, or how you reach out if there's an issue with a piece of equipment, or, you know, all these things are different process changes where your stakeholders want to understand why, how it's going to help them. And you basically have to be, in some degrees, a consultant. You've got to look at the data. You've got to look at the process. You've got to look at how this impacts people. You've got to develop a return on investment in terms of the time it saves each scientist for this process versus that, the implementation timeline, the strategy of how you're going to do that, the cost to implement, the long-term cost after implementation of what's going to save you or cost you, right? And if it costs you more, how does this justify the business need, right? So I can speak that database language, which helps you in the interactions with the scientists as well as senior leadership, I would assume, was trying to make database decisions, right? And the ways it's different is that you are also tasked with working a lot of stuff that a scientist doesn't care about.
Yeah.
Could, you know, in many ways, quite frankly, could care less what system they're using for orders, so long as they can do it quickly and get their stuff done and get back to their science, right?
Or they're actively avoiding it.
Right. Or signing your electronic lab notebook, or, you know, all these different things, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of your work, I would say the differences are it's sometimes less visible. It can be less easily seen. If you do an experiment, there's a presentation. Here's the data. Here's a decision point of, do we move forward with this project? We don't. We pivot. We try something else, you know, that sort of thing. Then operations, there is no pivoting there is no stopping what we're doing. It's how do we continue what we're doing and make it better without upsetting the entire system, right? You can't just say, we're not going to do orders for 6 months because we're going to work on a new system, right? And so it's a lot of that work in the background where you've got to continue current operations and business processes and business continuity without dropping the ball anywhere, while you're also sort of doing a side job of being an internal consultant to make your company and your operations better.
God, that's a really good way to put it. Cause like, there's the run the business type of things. And then there's the future looking like, how do we make the business better? But we can't make the business better without like dropping the ball of actually running the business right now. Right. And I think that's right. Kind of the point that you're getting at is like, you've got to be able to do like, the very tactical stuff of like, here's next steps, like the 1, 2, 3, the things that we need to do right now. And then here's like 19, 20, 21, and like be planning for that in the future, right?
Right, exactly. For instance, at Moderna Therapeutics, I've got a team of 6, you know, hiring more people that report to me or have people reporting to them, et cetera. We're supporting, you know, as I was saying, 300 to 500 scientists. They've all got workflows that have been well established. I've been there 6 months. And so there's all this historical stuff. And there's a part of you that's like, I want to just tear it all down and go back to base principles and make something really efficient. You can't, as I was saying, stop all that workflow. So you're tasked with both being a cheerleader for your team and making sure everyone feels really well supported, all the scientists feel really well supported, being the stopgap for everything that goes wrong. Hey, if you can't get a hold of this person, you can't, whatever, we are the solution to help offload everything. So you're putting yourself out there as on the firing line for people to come to you when there's a problem. And you've got to also demonstrate, you know, that you can fix those types of problems all of the time for them. And you also have these higher priorities, or not necessarily higher priorities, but more visible long-term big projects that are so cross-functional and complex. So for instance, doing a build out for new headquarters, 600,000 square feet. And, you know, I'm trying to support the research side of this. And so there's X number of floors for that. And you're trying to plan out all the equipment. And so you're looking at something that has historical data from, you know, a 10-year-old company that has thousands of pieces of equipment, and you're trying to update that in a process that you weren't there for when it was put together. It's hard to even understand. You're planning for all the equipment you're going to buy this year before you move. You're planning for all the equipment that you're planning years out after you're at this new building. And so you're trying to you have to deeply understand the science that all of these teams are going to be working on in the future, which if your company is rapidly growing as Moderna, it's increasing headcount 50% year over year for the last 10 years. We're 4,000 today and hiring another 2,000, you know, that's really hard. And so looking at that complex big picture, understanding it deeply, as you're saying, going way deep and down into the nitty gritty, but also being able to manage that high level project, it's competing pulls on you as a person, right?
Yeah.
So I would say not losing it when people come to me with things that I see as a small problem. And I'm like, you know, so sometimes you're just pressed for time, right? If someone's coming to you and, you know, it goes back to ruthless prioritization. An autoclave is down, a piece of equipment is down, you know, science has stopped over here. We have to get that moving in for this program, for this timeline. You know, we're competing in a very tight market for all these different areas and therapeutic areas and all that sort of stuff. And at the same time, over here, you're trying to make people feel heard and seen as the company is changing rapidly and they're not feeling part of the team. And you want to, you know, make sure that everyone stays feeling motivated because you're pushing everyone really hard on these timelines, that sort of stuff. So you're trying to be many different people in one day. So, you know, I would say what's hard is trying to get all those stakeholders aligned, hearing everyone out, making them feel heard and listen to, even if you have to do something strategically that makes their lives harder temporarily, for instance, rolling out a new procurement system or rolling out something that, oh, it's going to take them another X amount of time to learn this new thing, not a new tool, you know?
Yeah.
But the I would say, you know, beyond that, you know, your role in operations is making shit happen. And that's for making the scientists work. That's for making the company work and the operations work, the business side. So as leadership has these different priorities within the company and all these different directions that they're going strategically or wanting to pivot into, you are tasked with just making it happen. And sometimes you're at a place where you are handed something to make happen that you weren't at the table for deciding whether or not it was going to, you know, happen, right?
Yeah.
And at the same time, you are now tasked with rolling that out to all these scientists, you know, a new ELN, a new procurement system, a new whatever process, make it work. So sometimes rolling that out, if you weren't part of the table for the conversation, is difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. Like being a making decisions or like moving things forward without like the context. Yeah, I can imagine that makes a lot of sense. From my experience, people that started out in lab operations, like in graduate school, in postdoc, a lot of times the people that are doing lab management, that is just like oftentimes delegated to people, and from like in an academic environment, because you've got like these small labs, and so it's like somebody's got to order stuff, and like who's going to make the spreadsheet, and so like some graduate student or some postdoc takes on responsibility outside of their current job. And it sounds like that's a little bit the situation that you started out with at Dana-Farber.
Yeah, absolutely.
If someone was looking into this as a serious like career opportunity, I mean, what are the entry points? Is that generally what a career path would look like? And how is that evolving? Is like lab operations and operations in general? Do you see general trends that people kind of take as a career path?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a few different entry points within lab operations, but often people will be some sort of scientific role, either a research technician or scientist one or that sort of thing, postdoc, et cetera. And they were doing something supporting the lab, and they're wanting to make that more formally part of their career. And so they'll transition from a person who did 50% science and then was 50% ordering stuff, dealing with equipment negotiations or whatever the lab needed to make it run and make it work, to now I want that to be 100% of my job, and question is, where do I go from here? Well, so that path, if you're starting out, you know, first you're starting, I'll just give my experience, first you're starting to manage the lab, and then you go into managing people who manage the lab and manage the facilities and manage the support areas of, you know, autoclaving, glass washing, stuff like that. But then you grow into managing business operations and managing people in terms of legal contract process and that sort of stuff. You grow into managing the high level architectural build outs and construction projects. And on the digital side, you are the main point of contact for a digital team for all of their new rollouts, because you're the stakeholder that understands what the scientists need. And so you can tell them for the new build outs and processes what they're going to need in those new tools. You're going to tell them where the implementation timelines are going to be a problem due to program issues and that sort of thing, or program closeouts, etc. You can scale that and continue to grow into those adjacent roles. So as you're working, instead of just supporting procurement, you might take that on. Instead of just supporting budgeting, you might take on finance, that sort of thing. People will often become VP finance and operations, that sort of thing. I know a lot of people who started in lab operations who are now executive directors who control or manage within their remit HR, finance, as well as operations, and that can include facilities and safety and all this other stuff. At the end of the day, that career path for me presented a lot more creative problem solving than I had been experiencing just the bench. And the bench can be incredibly intellectually stimulating, right? But for me, as I was saying, I was already sick of pipetting. And so I was still engaged theoretically, but my day-to-day work, it was way more interesting to, negotiate and hardball people in a construction project meeting and trying to figure out timelines for these things and managing an architectural process and negotiating on, $1 million mass spec, and then sitting in a meeting with someone talking about how we need to capture our IP in an ELN properly to safeguard our business data for protection in the future, and then going to talk about, how we have an order on hold because AP's behind in our payments and working through those. You can span the gamut of creative problem solving in a day that just seemed a lot more interesting to me in my day-to-day work. And being a person who likes to be very engaged in context switching and lots of different problems seemed really exciting and keeps me very well engaged in my work.
That's cool. I'm going to ask you the awkward question, like from a compensation perspective. You talked about making $38K as a research tech. And you don't have to go into I'm not asking you to share your salary, because I think that's, super awkward to ask on a podcast.
Well, I'm happy to share.
Ballpark, what does it look like from a financial perspective going into, an operations type of role in biotech?
So when I started as research tech, I was 38 grand a year. When I became a lab operations manager, also this is an academia nonprofit, I was just under 50K a year. That was base salary, and academia doesn't have bonus. When I went to, after 5 years of experience, plus 4 years before that of internships and stuff, I went into startup biotech company and operations manager type role. I was just under 100K as a salary, plus, you get like a 10% bonus or something. And over time, startup, maybe that turns into something, maybe it's nothing, or with options and that sort of stuff, which I would say is equitable to someone who's coming out of a PhD and they get a good scientist position at a company, can expect to make just under around 100K, something like that. And then you move to sort of senior manager, associate director type roles within a smaller company like a startup, 100 people or something like that. You're going to see a significant difference than a larger company in your base salary and your bonus and that sort of stuff. But your options could be worth way more than if you're a large company, right? If your startup is successful. Now, being realistic, I would say that percentage of likelihood is under 20% of the time that becomes wildly successful, something like that. But I would say somewhere between 100 and 150 is your base. You might get more like a 15% bonus. As you go higher, your bonus percentage just gets higher as well within the level you are. now I'm at Moderna, and as an associate director, my base is over 200. And then I also have bonus, and you get, you know, options and stuff like that as well. So it is, you know, with about 10 years of experience, of course, it's a very colored experience of all these different areas you need to kind of move laterally to get. It can be a very lucrative career.
Yeah, I mean, that's super helpful information for people that are listening, and I appreciate you kind of going into detail like that, because those are the types of things where, you know, as you're thinking about an early stage career and like where I might go, there are things that people just don't talk about very often. So
I would say, you know, yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people are like, well, and that goes back to where I was, you know, as a young person in my early 20s, when I was thinking, what do I want to have as a career? I could be a doctor, I could be a lawyer, I could be, you know, a scientist, I could be these things, because I thought that's what I needed to do to be successful and make a good amount of, you know, income, live comfortably, have a family, and, you know, a expensive area, you know, cost of living, that sort of stuff. But what I have found in my experience of N of one has been making yourself incredibly valuable to a company is incredibly well rewarded, and whatever that role is. So for instance, operations has, as we were saying, that scalable effect across, you know, if your scientists don't have equipment that's up and running, it kind of doesn't matter how many they you have in the lab in terms of number of scientists, or how smart they are, or where their pedigrees are from, or how great they are if they can't do their experiments. And that goes for having reagents on hand, having a facility that is designed exactly for the type of work you need to do, to be, you know, within the right location, to have the right staff, to have the right, you know, team morale and vision and unity and all that sort of stuff. All those factors are intensely scalable across your impact. And so for my experience, it's something that companies are increasingly concerned about, making sure that role is filled by someone who is incredibly passionate, data-backed, and wants to make that big scalable impact across the team and understands that need.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. What you're saying is that, like, the more you can just bring value to the organization, the more valuable you'll actually be. It sounds yeah. You know, straightforward when you say it like that, but I think it's a salient point, because and especially it's kind of interesting from an operations and a lab ops perspective, because you know, if you're comparing it to what a scientist might make,
what would you say a scientist 10 years of experience at a small startup in a larger biotech might be able to make?
A scientist 10 years of experience, small startup,
yeah, you know, like comparable
after a PhD.
Sure, I'd be curious to hear someone who has PhD and someone who doesn't. In your opinion,
yeah, I mean, I think, I'm not entirely sure without a PhD, and you know, this is all a caveat to say, like, I didn't go this path and went a business route, and so I think it can vary pretty widely, but I would say after a PhD, 10 years of experience, you're probably looking in that range of 200-ish thousand and more, maybe. But like, but that's a lot of experience, and you know, one of the challenges, I think, to be honest with you, is from a biotech perspective, is that many people are coming into the field and being paid very mediocre, minimal wages from an academic perspective. Like, you know, I as a PhD student, I was making, I think, 32,000 when I first started, and then maybe 36 or 38 when I finished. As a postdoc, I was making $50,000 or $52,000. And this is a huge issue right now. The challenge, I think, in biotech is that you've got this massive potential workforce, because there's no academic jobs. And so people, are, you know, they're not sure what to do with their lives. And so a lot of times they'll go and they say, okay, like, working as a scientist at the bench is the thing that makes the most sense for me because it aligns with the skill set that I've already gained. And then, you know, in a way, you become a bit of a commodity, right? And it can be hard to differentiate yourself from like a financial perspective. And so, you know, the way that you compete and prosper economically is by gaining skill sets like from an analysis and a strategic level that other people don't have. But like, there's just this like base level of like becoming good at like doing the bench science. I think that there's a lot of people that are already doing that, and so the pay is a little bit lower, I would say. That's my perspective, but like, you know, I'm no expert here.
But all that to say, you know, there are many paths that you could go down as someone who has a scientific mindset, a scientific understanding, and wants to make a big impact in a scientifically based career. That could be biotech, that could be pharma, that could be other industries, that could be management consulting, etc. That isn't at the bench, but is still supporting science, that's still driving forward an impact in the world via, you know, a science-based industry like medicine, biotech, etc. And you can still make a very lucrative career. Even in my case, don't have a PhD, don't have an MBA. You know, it's like I'm Liam Neeson. I have a very particular set of skills. What can I say?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But that's incredibly useful to a company to have. You know, if you're looking at, you know, I'd be curious to ask my boss now that I've been there for 6 months why he selected me. Because when I was looking at the postings for this type of role, you know, it looks quite difficult.
Daunting.
To find someone who has a business acumen, who understands budgeting, you know, FP&A, equipment support programs, like overall how you support a equipment support program, architectural design, construction projects, has a deep scientific understanding of biology, the biological research process, the chemistry research process, you know, has been on biosafety boards and all that type of stuff, is a very, you know, mixed set of skills that you have to possess to be good at this role. And so the two sides of the coin is like you're kind of a jack of all trades, master of none, and that sometimes you've got to flex into these areas that you don't have experience in, but you are the person who needs to own and figure this out. So it's also an opportunity if that is a skill set, if that is an opportunity, a challenge that is exciting to you, where you could have a very impactful career and be very fulfilled with it.
Yeah, and I think the point that you're making is very broadly applicable, not just within operations, within any type of business function, is that having that baseline understanding of the science and like having experienced being a scientist working at the bench and the pains of some of that, and then building on that with like an adjacent skill set is hugely valuable. Like whether it's like you're a writer, or whether you're, you know, someone that works in like science policy, there are ways that you can utilize the scientific training and then like really differentiate yourself with these additional, you know, things that you acquire along the way. But like being intentional about it and having some sort of like idea of where you want to go, I think is the key, because you want to make sure that the skill set that you're actually developing is differentiated.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, I have the conversation with people I'm working on development and mentoring and that sort of stuff. I know someone right now who is a scientist and is looking at making a switch into working at venture capital, you know, and investments and vetting companies and that sort of thing. And they are quite excited to have someone who has a scientific background and that sort of skill set and training and understanding to bring that to the table to help with their analysis, to help with their whole processes there. So there's all these different areas you can go with that scientific mindset for your career that, you know, frankly, I don't think were clear to me when I were younger, but I don't think is also clear to most people because they're not in those kind of boxes that you think about of a possible career often when you're younger.
Yeah, I love that point that you bring up about the boxes. Sometimes you're kind of developing the boxes or like building the boxes as you go, and it feels like lab operations is one of those fields that is like emerging and getting bigger and more desirable. And so I'm curious to hear your, like, I know that you've been involved with Lab Ops Unite, and tell me a little bit about that organization. Like, what do you guys do and what's the purpose of it?
Yeah, so this Lab Ops Unite was founded just a few years ago during COVID as a way for Lab Ops professionals to connect. And so this could be for helping each other career-wise, sharing best practices for the industry, but also ask questions because this is not a well-standardized, ironed-out career path. You know, biotech and pharma, for instance, you know, there are some pharma companies that have been in existence since, you know, the 1800s that are still big today, right? But the path for a scientist may be well defined for them, but a path of how they support them in that operations role is not. That's pretty new. I would say the last 10, 15 years is where it's really become a dedicated career path. And so within Lab Ops Unite, this is an organization where we're now converting to 501c status as nonprofit. And our goal is to be a resource for people who are lab ops professionals within the industry, ask questions to each other, build each other up in terms of, you know, it's a group where people can ask questions about, I'm implementing a new ELN. What have people used previously? What have people used at different sizes of companies? You know, questions around we're buying or trying to fit out a vivarium. Lead time for, you know, cage racks is 9 months. What has people done instead? You know, that sort of thing. It's a resource for people to share knowledge, to connect, to help each other. But also we're trying to formalize and standardize this career path. So I'm on the leadership board for Lab Ops Unite, and I'm on the research committee. And one of the projects that I'm working on this year is trying to work on standardizing what these roles are and what is the remit of a lab manager and the leveling of that. Does it go, you know, lab ops technician to associate to specialist to this or that to manager? You know, what does that remit actually mean? What is that scope? Because you might hire someone who's doing autoclaving and glass washing, all this sort of stuff, as we were talking about earlier in terms of entry-level positions. But you also have people who are operations directors, who are, you know, managing these big construction projects, who are doing all these different things. What is the path for that? What is the skill set that's required? How do you compensate fairly for the market for that? That's a huge one right now where we're trying to understand with companies that do market salary data research, like Radford was one of the main ones in the industry for benchmarking salary data. But if you're trying to put someone in a box in a salary database like that, and the roles are not really there, and every HR department in the industry is trying to kind of, you know, finally slice apart these roles to compensate people and understand what they should be benchmarking these things for, it's not clear. And so that's one of the things that, you know, I as a leadership board member am working on a project, and we're hoping to put out a white paper this year on that to help standardize it for the industry and make that career path more, not just standardized, but visible and understood for people who are seeking a career within it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Lab Ops Unite is essentially like that scaler or the force multiplier of lab operations, right? Like, facilitating and enabling that as a career. I think it's an interesting point, like building, being involved in building a community like that is incredibly powerful from a career perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're connecting with other people within the same industry or otherwise, at the end of the day, as what I was saying, there's people who are transitioning out of, you know, biotech into venture capital, from venture capital into this other thing. There's kind of a revolving door of people who are very smart, who have a scientifically based understanding of the world and want to make an impact in it. And there's lots of companies that want those people working for them. And there's lots of people who, you know, who have like-minded skill sets and like-minded visions of what they want the future to look like. We're very interested in starting new companies together. And so if you're trying to build these communities, build a community where someone can talk to each other about these needs and you become an expert within this community or share your expertise a lot and it's valued and you're helping mentor people, you're on a pretty short list when someone starts a new company saying who in, you know, this small group of people that's, you know, for better or worse, kind of clicky within venture capital saying, hey, this new CEO, we're putting this new company together. They're going to need someone who's going to lead operations. It's a pretty short list.
That's a great point. You do some other things outside of your day job, and you talked about it a little bit, your music. Tell me a little bit about like your journey that you're going down right now, building a band.
Yeah, for sure. So when I was in Albuquerque and my boss passed away and suddenly I found myself without a job, my job suddenly became live in my parents' basement and make music. And so I made some albums where I did everything myself. And it was sort of that roll up your sleeves and figure it out process where I had played guitar for years, loved music, couldn't sing at all, didn't have all the right gear. So I figured it out, just like moving to Boston and figuring it out. I bought all the recording equipment. I watched YouTube videos and figured out how to record and do all the stuff. And I ended up making some albums where I did all the parts. I wrote the songs, sang all the lyrics, played all the instruments, recorded, mixed, mastered, produced. I started making music videos on YouTube and stuff and learning how to film things and cut and edit and all that kind of stuff. Fast forward, I moved out to Boston. I was doing some stand-up as on the side for fun and met a guy who was also a stand-up comedian who played drums and we formed a band. So we've been playing together for years, but there's a new iteration of this band that we put together recently. And our new band's iteration is called Jake in the Box, box with two X's, B-O-X-X, like Jack in the Box. And so he plays drums and like a two-piece, like the White Stripes, the Black Keys, sort of hard bluesy rock stuff. And then I'll do all the other parts. There's several bands who make music where it's just one person actually doing all the recordings. So like Tame Impala is one. Dave Grohl and some of the early Foo Fighters albums did something similar because he was obviously a fantastic drummer and was learning how to play guitar or knew how to play guitar and was becoming more known for that at the time, right? So it's not entirely uncommon, but it definitely, I would say, is generally a bit harder. But it's feasible if you're passionate. And so for me, we just put this new EP together earlier this year. Self-titled release of Jake in the Box on Spotify and iTunes and all this stuff. And we're working on, we already have most of another follow-up to that ready. This one was released early in January and we're preparing a bigger release for a full album sometime within the next few months. But it's very exciting and, you know, it's a connector. I think at the end of the day, people are multifaceted, right? So people are you know, outside of work, they still have lives, right? I've met a lot of people playing music who have that scientific connection. I met a lot of people at Moderna who play in bands, orchestra, and stuff like that. I've met people who were in vice presidents of science at Moderna who'd gigged and had been in bands, toured and stuff.
That's rad.
I know all sorts of people who, this is a huge thing that I know. The guy who works on our digital team, who is a manager of Boston Calling, the big music show here in Boston each year. You know, it's a passion that I think you're more exciting as a person, but you're also more invested in life itself, and you find it more meaningful when you're actually pursuing what you find really engaging in the world and not being afraid to share that with the world. There's a lot of people, I think, who have passion projects, right? And for some other reason, they don't seem to prioritize it. I think that's a huge waste. I think the world wants to hear what you find really amazing, because there's a reason you really find it amazing.
Wow. That's awesome. I love that. You don't have enough going on, man. You need to pick up some hobbies here.
But I think that's one of the things that makes operations work for me. You know, I like new challenges, new things keep my mind engaged. I get kind of bored easily, and so every day is a new problem to solve, something to tackle, right? So it's been a great career path for me because I get creative problem solving every day. More stressed than I would like at times, and less relaxing than if I were just, you know, being a musician. But, you know, definitely, I think making a huge impact and also very fulfilling.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, well, if there's any advice that you had, you've given a lot of great advice already. So, but if there's anything that kind of came up in your thoughts as we were talking, you know, that would be relevant to someone that's currently working in science and looking to figure out like what their next career steps would be, what would you say to them?
You know, I would talk to people. I would talk to a lot of people in areas that you might be interested in, that you think you're probably not interested in, but you should talk to them anyway as well. There's a lot of stuff. So when I was, you know, when I was a research technician, I didn't know there was a whole career in lab management or what that meant. Lab management, I mean, just the words, it kind of sounds like, well, what does that entail? I mean, is it facilities? There's a facilities team. Is it safety? I mean, there's a safety team. Is it procurement? There's a procurement team, right? But I would talk to other people. I would, if you're someone with a scientific mindset, every career, every company is going to want to hire someone who's smart, diligent, and is a hard worker and is passionate about doing things that make a big impact. And that is a very broad area that your skill set is applicable. So don't self-select boxes for yourself when there could be a great career outside of that.
Oh, such good advice. I love it. Jake, this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing your wisdom, and also like the transparency and the honesty, because I think more than anything else, that's what helps people make decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. I try to share what I wish someone had told me. You know, a lot of questions. There was a lot of unknown when I arrived here in Boston from Albuquerque. I didn't know what to ask. I didn't know where to start. And so I would just encourage you, if you are in this career field or in a scientifically based discipline, to reach out to people who are in careers that you think you might be interested in, to learn more about it. To be open and honest with yourself about what you find interesting, and you know, seek a path that works for you instead of trying to put yourself in one.
Yeah, a Jake in the box.
Exactly.
All right, hey, I put in a plug. Don't you forget that.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Of course. No, it's really good, actually. I've listened to it, and it does have like a kind of a White Stripes feel, which I love the White Stripes. You know, Jack White's a pretty amazing musician.
Oh, it's incredible. Yeah, I saw him at the the Ryman Theater, the original Grand Ole Opry Ryman Theater in Nashville, just before the pandemic started.
Oh, really? That'd be so cool. Yeah, he just wails. He's like, and then his voice is so distinct, you know. It's a really interesting combination.
You know, when I was in high school, I thought Jack White was because I was fascinated by people who could just play incredibly fast, incredibly like Slash or Van Halen and stuff like that. But he was playing so simply, and I was like, I could do that. I mean, he's just playing Seven Nation Army. It's a very simple riff. He just plays the whole riff, the whole song. There's nothing, you know, really that complicated. As you gain experience as a musician, the really simple things are really hard to do really, really well.
Interesting.
And that's something, you know, I'm gonna. It might be a stretch, but I'll pull it back to operations here. That making your scientific operations, making your business really efficient, it sounds pretty easy. It sounds simple. It's really hard to do well.
Do you actually? That's a pretty good analogy. I like it. that's great. Well, thanks so much, Jake. It's been fun. I appreciate coming on again, and excited for people to listen to the album.
Thanks, Nick.
This is the Once a Scientist podcast. I'm Nick Edwards, the host and producer. Caroline Sferrazza and Sam Asenoff co-produced the show. If you like this episode, please consider sharing it with a friend, and thanks for listening.